This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
But I'd like to just thank everyone for their participation through the day and asking questions. And here's another opportunity for you to ask questions during our closing panel session. Now, this is relatively unstructured. What I'm going to do is, once we've got the mic set up, I'm going to ask Dick Kimber, Alice Springs historian, to talk for about 15 minutes on his Leichhardt work. And then we'll throw it open to yourselves to ask questions. I've got a few in mind, I'm sure you have. And I'm sure some of the panellists here too would like to ask some of their colleagues some curly and maybe not so curly questions. So once we've got Dick set up, we'll start off.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all the fantastic speakers. It's great to be down here. I'd like to just make a few comments on some of the more historical aspects to do with the discovery of the butt plate and where it might be. But first I'll touch on Philip's talk. Madigan, who crossed the Simpson Desert, as many people know, he was talked about this Blackpool Hotel and what a... he basically said it was a bit of a con job and a bulldust story. And I talked with Rex Lowe, the son of Edwin Lowe, and he was hugely offended about that. He said it was absolutely fair dinkum. I also talked to two of the Aboriginal stockmen who worked on the station at the time. And one of them said that the first discovery was by one of the Aboriginal stockmen, and it was of a gold sovereign. And that discovery was... Edwin Lowe, the father, went down to Adelaide and had that at the Black Bull Hotel and actually spent it at the bar. So that was the loss of one very good relic. The other thing I think on Phillips that he didn't emphasise, and I understand he was taking a different line, is that it is truly remarkable to find two coins pre-1848 in the middle of sort of effectively nowhere at a place where, after the skeletal finds were found to be nowhere nearly as substantial as they thought, to actually find those is a fluke of all flukes, I think. And that's why there's always been a bit of an interest in that as a possible Leichhardt place, and it'll remain unresolved unless you find his still Leichhardt box with his diary in it next door over the next sandhill. I've been lucky to go out there and poke around myself. It is easy from a bit of a distance to look at those tree roots and think they look like skeletal material. I did find a few teeth, as you know, bits of leather, very old-looking leather, and otherwise I only found Aboriginal artefacts there, and I looked along the ridges because I thought anyone who's camping there would camp up, sit up on the ridges, look out where you're going to go and that, and I couldn't find anything up there either. The bit that I'll go back to the gun plate, and Darryl's ideas about it, which I applaud. He's done wonderful research and given you a great story, but I don't think he's right. And the reason I'll take that line is because there's another good alternative story for it, neither of which are very provable. In the case of the Simpson Desert proposal, which has come up a couple of times in people's view, I think it is possible that he decided to go direct. I take Darryl's viewpoint that he had to look at the where the rivers were flowing, find those points of the landscape that were allowing the rivers to flow whichever way they were, and then also his proposal was to find the northern part of the Simpson. As was said before, 1847 was a very wet year, so I think 1848 he probably went out in a very good season, and it would have been much easier travelling than is likely in some other seasons to travel where I'm going to propose he went. The proposal comes from the fact that in 1864 a man called Jarvis, who took stock up to the Macumba River, which is immediately south of the Simpson Desert, he reported from Aboriginal people who spoke the same Utterbunna language as where the station was he was managing further south, said to him that a group of men had perished a long time ago. In fact, they'd been killed, not perished, they'd been murdered a long time ago, and he used the word Tiriwa, which means to the east, but everyone thought it was a place name. So all the early people were looking for a place name when in fact it was a direction. And the indications are that it was either east or northeast. And between 1864 and 1890, there are about 7 or 8 accounts of this same story. And I got a wonderful oral history from a very old man on exactly this story, with, in that case, 7 skeletons. He didn't know anything, just named them by finger and got that. And it seems to me there's a real possibility that you had this situation where they came in to the northeast of the Simpson, then skirted around it as was the proposal, and followed down one of the river systems and ended up having a chance to come out near where Philip mentioned about the coins and the bones. And part of the reason I say that is that I accepted the version that the young man said, Bristow Smith, he's not lying, he's telling you what he believed, that the gun butt plate had been found in a bottle tree in the Musgrave Ranges near the West Aussie border. However, in response to that correspondence, a man called J.F. Hill, who had been doing droving with Charles Harding and knew Joe Harding, his brother, he commented that the... I'll just say what he says, that... it was discovered in the Northern Territory a day's journey before they got to the Musgrave Range. Now, he had seen the gun butt plate, he knew Charles Harding, and he knew Joe Harding, his brother. Joe Harding's actually a much, much better known man than Charles Harding. And if you take where Philip talked about the coins, he owned that cattle station, which went from about where the coins are found, in fact, Charlotte Waters area in South Australia, straight north up the edge of the Simpson Desert, where present-day Diane Dado station is on. Now, another point in that favour of that a bit is that there's also a place called Inkerman that is mentioned, and no one's been able to nail down. There's been a bit of discussion of an Inkerman in Queensland. There's an Inkerman station established in the 1880s, as I recall, up in the Gulf Country of Carpentaria. There's Inkerman down near Lee Creek. There's as many Inkermans as there are Musgrave Ranges. And I'd normally look at the Musgrave Ranges of South Australia as the likely chance, and also knew of the Western Australian ones. But there's a place called Inkermina, which is, in Aboriginal language, would be shortened to Inkerman, which is Mount Day, and it's almost where Philip, only just north of where Philip was talking about. So that you've got both Musgrave Ranges, the station was called Mount Musgrave. So that you've got Mount Musgrave, Inkermina, and you've got the discovery. Now, they're all pure coincidence, as far as I know, but it makes a nice story if you add them together. I find it really interesting that there's been a search in about 1915 for Leichhardt's cash box, and that was on Aboriginal accounts, and supposedly Aborigines were bringing in coins, sovereigns, from the northern Simpson Desert. And a famous prospector went out looking for it, and he took out with him the younger brother of a man called Sandhill Bob. And this younger brother had only heard the country, had never been there. So he took the wrong man, because Sandhill Bob knew the locality. And I've got this, what I think's a great story from this other old Aboriginal bloke who travelled with Sandhill Bob and knew him well. And I think Sandhill Bob's the same man who showed Lindsay the Simpson Desert. When Lindsay, the explorer, was trying to find someone to guide him, they said, there's only one man who knows it, this man, and he couldn't say his name, so he called him Bob. And that's the man, the only man who knew the sandhills of that area where they travelled. So I'll just postulate that there's a bit of a chance that this steel box, with Leichhardt's diary totally intact inside, is out there somewhere. And I wish you well in finding it, the man who's travelling down the Plenty River this night, because that's where it's meant to be. So good luck. I'll leave it at that, and I know there's lots of people with lots of questions I'd like to ask. I could ramble on, but I won't.
Thank you very much, Dick. That was great to hear some more stories about Leichhardt. And, yep. And following on some of the things that we've heard already, Daryl, would you like to respond at all?
Yes. It's a compelling story, but it leaves out the fact that Sturt Creek was part of the place, the location, according to the story collected by the Royal Geographical Society, and it doesn't take into account the, all the L trees that I talked about going up the Barku and along the Flinders and on the Cloncurry and further to the west. And it doesn't take into account Leichhardt's off-stated plan to go exactly where I say he went. So I just don't aware that he would abandon his Humboldtian plan, the grand plan to not just do the Northern Simpson, but to do the inlanding of the watersheds. And he would go along the watersheds because he'd know there's water there and then probe in, rather than go in where he didn't know there was water because there's no known rivers, and then probe to the watersheds. I can't see that. So would have to disagree, but I'm really glad, after 30 years of waiting for Dick to explain his theory about Leichhardt, I have finally heard, I'm sure, a very abbreviated version. So thank you, Dick. It's terrific.
Thank you, Daryl.
Philip, would you like to comment at all?
I know that Cleland's article on the plate and Grenfell Price's article on the sort of synthesis of the possible directions probably do give room, certainly for Dick's theory there, and the name of that place that they were looking for is certainly mentioned several times in there, together with the oral histories of the Aboriginal people. One of the things that did come out of the 1938 expedition was the fact that Aboriginal people were certainly remembering, it appears, the H. Vere Barclay expedition, 1904, and the Stewart expedition, 60, 61, 62. So this appeared to be something verifiable in the 1938 story. Going further back to an earlier oral history in 1938 with those Aboriginal people didn't seem possible to Mountford. Yeah. So you're suggesting that it could have been possible 20 or 30 years later.
So perhaps if I can just briefly comment, there's the accounts between 1864 and 1890, the most important expeditions, one by Ebenezer Flint, who was at the telegraph station and had been in the Barrow Creek attack and survived that, and he went out with Winicky the explorer and with Shirley the mounted constable, who was later perished up much further north in the territory, and they got accounts from Aboriginal people, different groups of them, as to where this murder had occurred. And he asked young Aboriginal men who could tell him the story through a translator, and then he got a much older man and asked him the story, and he was the one who remembered it. And on the basis of his estimates of ages, it's between 1843 and 1848 when this spearing and attack occurred. The other point I probably should have mentioned is that much as I think the coins are fascinating, and you've got that, there's actually a place called Anniversary Ball, which one of the Lowes named in the 1940s, but its actually original name was Taylor Well. And there's an old man called Dick Taylor who'd been in the, not quite in the charge of a light brigade, he's a bit later than that, but he dug that well and lived in that area for a time, so it's a chance that something like his waistcoat or something like that with the coins was either left behind at a camp accidentally, purloined by someone or whatever. So there are other alternative explanations. I could put up an argument against Daryl, but I won't.
Okay, now, in Philip's presentation, of course, we heard reference to and saw images of Frank Fenner a few years ago. And I was just wondering, Frank, would you like to make any comment on your experience at that time and the great misfortune in you not actually making it onto the expedition?
Thank you very much. Just to put it in perspective, I was at the time in my final year of medicine, but since my second year, I'd spent a large part of my holidays and lunch times in the basement of the South Australian Museum, where Tyndale had an enormous collection of Aboriginal skulls. I'd been involved in the Board of Anthropological Studies ran expeditions into Central Australia to the chairman was Cleland, the professor of pathology, and in my second year, the man that did the measurements of the width of the nose and the height of the person and the length of their limbs and all that sort of thing, he'd gone to England, and Campbell, who was a friend of my father, was the organiser of the expeditions, and he asked me to go up and do that sort of work. So after that, which I went on three expeditions, and after that I got involved in the study of the skulls and wrote several papers on it, and the longest one has got by F.J. Fenner, honorary craniologist to the South Australian Museum. I don't think there's been another craniologist in the world. Anyhow, those things were put together, and I got an M.D. for that work while I was away at the war. But it was that experience that led to the idea I could certainly recognise an Aboriginal skull and differentiate it from, I could tell the ones from Northern Australia from those from Southern Australia. That's what they want to put me on the expedition for, and then just before it took off, I was in the Adelaide University hockey team, and somebody hit a ball which hit my patella, and I thought it could play on, but I had a fall over, and I spent the next 6 weeks in a hospital rather than going up to with Grenfell Price and Company. That's the background to it.
Do you recall your feeling or the atmosphere in Adelaide when this expedition was being... do you recall your feeling or the atmosphere in Adelaide as this expedition was being planned and considered and spoken about?
Well, I think they thought there really was a chance of finding something out about Leichhardt, because the report had said that there were skeletons there. As we saw in some of those photographs, the skeletons were rather odd things. The remarkable thing is, I think, that they did find those coins and other material.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Frank. I'd like to put a question to our scientific speakers today, Tom and Henry and Rod. We've heard how we are starting to really recognise and appreciate Leichhardt's contribution to science, as too few people have done in the past, with the exception perhaps of von Mueller and others. But can I ask you, how well regarded was Leichhardt as a scientist by his peers? I mean, he was only here for a few years, but did he make much of an impact scientifically in those few years?
It's clear that before he went out on his expedition, while he was in Sydney and naturalising in the New England and so forth, as we heard, the leading scientists of Sydney, insofar as aware, and he regarded him at least as their peer and probably as their superior. They recognised him as a very well-trained scientist indeed. And we saw a bit of that in somebody's overhead. I can't remember whose it was, where he was... Oh, was it Lynn's poem or something? Where he's clearly described as a scientist.
And he's always been well regarded by scientists. They've never fallen prey to the Chisholmian interpretation.
I can understand a little bit better, having been here today, why von Mueller kept wanting to support searches going out, trying to answer the riddle of Leica, because clearly he had a lot of feeling for him. Can any of you give us a bit more of a flavour of the relationship between the two, etc.?
There wasn't one.
They never met,
because
of course.
Von Mueller succeeded.
Mueller arrived in South Australia on the 10th of December 1847. There's no chance that he was ever going to meet Leichhardt. But quite early on, he realised that Leichhardt was overdue. He might have been the first person who recognised that Leichhardt was overdue. He actually wrote to Sir Thomas Mitchell sometime in 1849 and suggested that it was time to put an expedition together to go and search. And that wasn't done, of course. And thereafter, Mueller was, I was going to say obsessed, but that's a bit too strong, but he was always very interested to promote searches for Leichhardt. Initially, he thought there was a real chance that at least some members of the party might survive, marooned in an oasis out there in the desert somewhere, and it was our duty to go and rescue them. Later, when he realised there was no chance of anybody still being alive, he was still anxious to know what had happened. And at every possible opportunity, he put together or encouraged people to put together new expeditions. Whenever a new report emerged, he was very anxious to get somebody to do it. Persuade Sir Thomas Elder to put up some more money to fund another expedition. Mueller was going to be the leader of the expedition that Darrell mentioned right at the end of his talk, that Forrest finished up leading, that went out to Lake Bali. But Mueller was going to be the leader of that until right at the last minute he pulled out, and Forrest, who had going to, it was intended would be the second in command, took it over.
There is an irony in the fact that Mueller's reputation, or a significant part of it, was made on the collections that he made on a Gregory expedition, which retraced a major part of Leichhardt's track 10 years previously, and which Leichhardt, of course, lost. He lost those specimens, but Mueller kept his.
Leichhardt didn't lose all of his.
Either. Not all.
He had Leichhardt's collection, which, as I said, is still in Melbourne.
Yes. Yeah.
What I meant to say also, I think Mueller developed, because of his experiences on the Gregory expedition and the fact that he traversed basically the same country on the way from the Victoria River back to Moreton Bay, and he developed a strong sense of sameness, I think, with Leichhardt that reinforced his concerns about getting out there and rescuing these people if it's at all possible.
Or so he really identified with Leichhardt?
I think so, yeah.
Can I make a point? During one of the talks, someone said that von Mueller was very fixed on the notion that Leichhardt perished around the Simpson Desert. That was a 1938 expedition, I think, when they were promoting that idea. But von Mueller clearly wasn't fixed on the Simpson Desert. He was fixed on whatever new evidence came up. And when Alec McPhee found Jungun in the desert and heard the story about the perishing white men, that story got back to von Mueller, and von Mueller was very keen to get an expedition going, and he did, through Sir Thomas Elder. So I just wanted to make that point, that he wasn't totally fixed on the Simpson Desert. He would have been at certain times when the evidence was pointing that way, but as the evidence came in, for instance, when they found the first of the elder trees on the Flinders, well, on the Cloncurry River, I think it was Flinders or Cloncurry, I've seen his correspondence, and he's highly excited, saying this shows that he didn't get killed in southwest Queensland, he went way up to the north to the Gulf. And he kept on doing that as new evidence came in. Although sometimes he ignored it. A story came in from an old camel man who'd been out on the Leichhardt Ladies Search Expedition in the 1860s, and according to the story, he promised the dying leader of the expedition that he would keep searching. And 20 years later, he came into Camel Wheel or somewhere, claiming he had found all his skeletons and relics in a tree marked L on a big grass plain somewhere. And the local story got back to von Mueller, who then contacted the local policeman to ask if this camel man was reliable, and the policeman said no, he's not, so he never followed it up. But for all we know, he had found Leichhardt's remains. I mean, it's a very complicated story.
Tom, yes, could you speak to the mic, please?
You ask for the contemporary scientists what they thought of him. I think perhaps Clark's attempt to publish the German paper, even though it was published in such an obscure Australian periodical, he did go to a lot of trouble. And in there is an introduction to the work in which he expressed his feelings about Leichhardt, and he obviously felt that he was a very, very good geologist. So I think that answers your question.
Thank you. So from the audience, a question or two. Peter, can we just wait for the mic, please?
And thank you all. It's been a really interesting day. Partly because, even though I confess I know nothing of these matters, it revolves around the discussion of evidence and the interpretation of the conflicting evidence, which we've seen most clearly coming from Daryl and from Dick. Thank you. One of the things that I'm intrigued by is, and I found Daryl's presentation this morning very persuasive, and I don't want to be persuaded by it. I want the complexity of the evidence to be worked through, which is why I was so pleased that Dick put a countervailing view, if briefly, just now. And it just occurs to me that it may not be the greatest mystery in Australian history. I used to work at the Australian War Memorial, and we used to say that the loss of HMAS Sydney was the greatest mystery in Australian history. So, and that brings me to suggest that about 20 years ago, there was a cache of items, artefacts, allegedly from HMAS Sydney, which were allegedly found on the coast of Western Australia, and the memorial was asked to pronounce on its authenticity, not simply one plate such as we have before us, but a whole rag bag of bits and pieces. And one of the ways in which we approached this perplexing physical evidence was to ask one of our young colleagues to assume it was authentic, and to argue the case for its authenticity. And in doing so, of course, he very comprehensively proved to everybody that it was in fact a complete crock, and there was nothing authentic in it. There was biro stains on the cloth, for example, which couldn't possibly have existed in 1941. So that was. But the point is, it's an interesting technique, and I wonder, rather than be persuaded by Daryl's evidence, which I intellectually I feel it probably is, but I'd like us to consider other explanations. And maybe in our panel today we should have had a Patrick White to come up with alternative explanations which might be consistent with the great variety of evidence that we've seen. And the more I hear of the surrounding evidence to the plate, the more intrigued I am as to possible explanations. I mean, is it possible Leichhardt was lost? I don't know. Is it possible that he went to where Daryl said he was, up on the Tanami Desert, and turned south? Is it just possible that he did come into northern South Australia? I mean, I don't know. I feel such an idiot in these matters. But there are many people before us who can pronounce authoritatively on this. And I'm just wondering, can we turn our minds to different ways of thinking of the provenance of the undoubtedly authentic plate that we're examining, to try and think of different ways in which this plate can come to have been in the place where it is? So can we think laterally? Sorry, that's a very convoluted question, but I see David's understood, so...
David?
I think there's another way of going, and that is, if we make the assumption that the plate is real, we ask the plate where it's been. And we don't know at the moment exactly what evidence is bound up in those crevices and cracks in the plate. There may be pollen. The problem with that is that the methods required to do pollen analysis may not be appropriate for the plate. There may be mineralogical evidence. Don't know. Let's see. Well,
but you don't want to scrape bits out of it, do you?
No, I don't want to scrape it, but maybe a little tickle.
But I'd go digging.
Just in case anyone here doesn't know the significance of pollen, every plant species has a very distinctive pollen. They're microscopic, and they can be usually identified as to species. So if there was pollen trapped in the crevices of the corrosion or in the stamped lettering, and you know, you could get it identified. You could find some and get it identified. You might be able to say, this plate has pollen in it which only comes from the monsoon vegetation, or it comes from Central Australia or somewhere else. So if it was South Australian pollen, well then, of course, the plate was carried back to this man's house, so it wouldn't count. But if it was northern pollen or central pollen, you might be better off. I mean, it's just a good chance that there's something like that can be looked at, that's all.
I might... Yes, Dick.
Sorry, just one comment on your comments. I've examined about 100 different places where bones or relics or carved trees or whatever have been found, including all those Darryl mentioned. But I ended up, because of the nature of the talk, I had to restrict it to a limited perception. So I think there's vast numbers of red herrings everywhere, some of them going straight into total confidence people and so on like that. So I think the idea, it was actually in the Grenfell Price map, indicated certain of the points you're making. So thanks for the comments, though.
No, thank you. And I think that's exactly why we need to think of alternative ways of reading the evidence. And though Darryl's argument is really persuasive, it's just possible that there are other... And you clearly think a different view, and maybe there are different ways of seeing it. Is it possible that you might be persuaded, Dick, to write something which yes. reflects on that?
I've already written something that hadn't been published, but I guess I actually think that the most significant stuff is that which is available, that is scientific evidence, you know, that wonderful sense of science that has been discussed by Henry and others. That's a crucial element about what LIHCA is about. But in human interest terms, as Darryl said, possibly Australia's greatest mystery in inland exploration anyway, I find that a fascinating element of the story. So, yes, I'll try and get something organised. I'll talk with Darryl about that, perhaps Aboriginal history or something like that, to have a bit of a go. But thank you for the thought.
Don't forget the museum has its own journal and that they'd be dying to publish it, Dick.
I might just say, Peter, that we started off from the position of not assuming that it was genuine. Rather, we started at the opposite extreme, you know, and as David's presentation particularly showed, you know, we started off testing scientifically the object. And I don't think we would have made a decision to purchase based purely on the historical record, because, as with all evidence, there's conflicts in the story. But we decided to go to the evidence which is immutable, so the scientific analysis and the way in which that analysis could either refute or support the historical record. You know, people have said, well, you haven't found the Boab tree with the L marked, and how do you know that is true? Well, okay, we haven't. We are getting closer to the idea of an expedition out to have a look at it. But we decided, you know, the tree might not exist anymore. You know, trees only live for a certain amount of time. You know, they die in bushfires, they collapse, etc. It might not be there now. So if you couldn't find the tree, does that refute the whole story? So we decided to look for the evidence which doesn't change, and that's the scientific analysis. So which parts of the story does that back up? And David pointed out some really key planks in the historical story which are corroborated by the scientific analysis, and that gave us the confidence to go ahead with the purchase. And it's a fascinating process to be able to turn to the scientific world to back up the historian's way of approaching these things. Mike Smith, I think, had the next question.
Mike Smith from the museum. This is a question for Darryl, David, Dick, maybe Philip, anyone else on the panel.
It'd be Tom, Dick and Harry.
I mean, apart from, say, finding a bit of early Prussian dentistry, how do we know when we found Leichhardt or the remains of his party, what would we look for in terms of the condition of the objects? Specifically, how would we know we had an object of approximately the right age? What sort of gear would we hope to find when we walk over that sand dune with a string of camels in the Kalakupa country? What clinches it? What distinguishes the remains of Leichhardt from the remains of, say, people associated with the construction of the Overland Telegraph Line in 1871, or Aboriginal stockmen associated with one of the stations in the 1880s, and so forth?
Who'd like to go first?
I'm willing to have a bit of a go. First up, the OT line, under Todd's instructions, asked everyone to keep their eye open for it. Nucky did a great deal of exploration. Nucky's accounts to Todd are very interesting, and they got no evidence whatsoever of anyone having crossed the line from all the available evidence they could see. It doesn't mean that they didn't cross the line. As such, they didn't find any between 1870 and 1872. The other thing is that one of the things I've been told about that's out in a tree, it's wedged in a tree, the tree's grown around it, is a yoke. And I think that's interesting in that they had the bullocks that they took had yokes, I believe. They were pack bullocks, and they're going to eat their way west as they sort of got there. And you might find something like that, which, with the kind of analysis that David did on metal, you'd be that'll be your best bet. Other than, as I said, if you find Leichhardt's steel trunk with L. Leichhardt on it with his journal, you've got a good one.
You might have a good one. It might be a fake.
I think one of the other things is obviously to look for the gun. I mean, if it was disposed of by a tree with an L on it, well, that's the obvious thing to go for. But that still doesn't find Leichhardt.
No, it's only the non-smoking gun. The firearm technology that Leichhardt had was cap and ball or muzzle-loading technology. By the time the telegraph line was going in, it was right on the changeover. There still would have been quite a few muzzle-loading, especially pistols, around in 1871, but the breech-loading, modern-style, brass-shell firearms were coming in fast. By the time the settlers got into the Kimberley and the Victoria River District in 1883, very few muzzle-loading guns. By the time the prospectors would have been probing from the Kimberley field into the Great Sandy, for instance, it's extremely unlikely they would have had any muzzle-loading guns. They may have, but very unlikely. So if in the Great Sandy, for instance, you found powder flasks, which belong to muzzle-loading technology, or the remains of an iron gun, which you could still see it's got the hammer and the separate lock on the side, or would have been on the side when the wood was there, and a nipple at the end and not an opening for a cartridge, it's a muzzle-loader, it's highly unlikely it would be from the telegraph line or settlers, especially the settlers, could be from the telegraph line times. It could have been traded in, but it's just as likely it would be Leichhardt. And then also there's the brass surveying equipment, you know, the sextants and the compasses usually made of brass. The brass is still there. It'd be corroded, no doubt, but it's not like iron, which rusts and deteriorates a lot faster. So if you found 1840s period surveying equipment, it's highly unlikely it's come from the 1870s, 80s, 90s, or more recently. Most of the equipment, though, would be indistinguishable, I think, from the same items, plates, cups, axes, from 50 years later, especially after it's been rusted for a long time. So most of the equipment, if you could find something, you wouldn't really know it was Leichhardt's, but there's definitely various objects, some of which may well have been engraved with his name on the telescope, for instance, or some of the other gear. I believe that a set of surveying equipment was given to him before he left by the surveying department in Queensland. I don't know if they engraved anything on them or not, but now, there are certain objects which you could work out belong to the 1840s period, and it depends where you are in Australia. In northern South Australia, it's so much closer to civilisation of the times that perhaps stuff was stolen or, you know, found by Aborigines and traded in, and it's not quite so big a... what's the word? It's not so far away, and it's a lot earlier. Well, 1840s, say, in South Australia, it's not that terribly far to Mount Dare, for instance, if you found some stuff there, or in the Simpson Desert. But the Great Sandy Country is a lot further away in time and distance.
Yeah, I think the only comment I'd make on that that's problematic is that you can find as much equipment as you like. They could have gone on with their pack bullocks or surviving whatever, or on foot for another 300 miles or something like that before they all perished, or scattered all over the countryside. And, you know, I mean, the dilemma is to find skeletal evidence or if there's none of that surviving, which is a possibility except in fragmented way, you'd have to find... I really think you'd have to find his journal to say otherwise. I can't think how you'd otherwise prove anything.
If you could find a skull and there were teeth, you could, and it's been done, it's possible, extract DNA from the inside of those teeth, and Leichhardt has living, not direct descendants, but from his own family, there are descendants in the US, and they have visited Australia, so it would be possible to do that kind of testing. And that would be pretty conclusive, I would suspect.
The wonders of science strike again. Mike?
I've just got one follow-up. Daryl, I think in your presentation you talked about Leichhardt being fairly careful about his equipment and maybe even numbering or labelling or his equipment. Did you know, did he do that? Did he have an inventory? Did he have numbers stamped on saddlebags and things?
It wasn't me who said that, but there's a letter which is partly damaged, but it's quite clear enough that he's been marking all his equipment. Now, we don't know with what. It might have been so that all the equipment that belonged in one pack bag was in that pack bag, and everything was numbered, so you could put things into the... You would know if the stuff was. You didn't hunt through five bags to find the nail cutters or something, you know. You'd go straight to it. So I don't think it would have been all labelled LL or Ludwig Leichhardt. But if you found something like a bullock bell, which had a number on it, it just gives it that little bit more of a possibility that it was numbered and was part of Leichhardt's equipment, but it doesn't prove anything. And the other possible way you might be able to more readily pin down whether a relic you found was Leichhardt's is if there was an Aboriginal oral tradition that, like the one I put forward for the Great Sandy, that, you know, these four white men perished. I don't know if that oral tradition has survived. No one I know has recorded it. But if someone went out tomorrow to Balgo or someone like that and asked the old men, did you ever hear about four men on horseback, white fellows on horseback, perishing something? They say, oh, yeah, down there in that particular name spring. And then you go hunt around there in the sandhills and you find an old muzzle-loading gun or a powder flask. There's a bit of a link. It gives a bit more credibility to the possibility. But you can't prove anything by like that without finding, as you say, the DNA in the skull or the journal.
One thing that's interested me for a long time are the old trees. And there's been very little discussion of the nature of the blaze and the L and how that was carved and where it is on the tree trunk and on which side of the tree. And a retired surveyor from Dalby in Queensland has been doing just this, and he's actually rediscovered L trees on the Darling Downs, which is highly developed. You know, it's all cultivated. He's actually, some of them were dead and lying on the ground as logs, but he'd calculated where the camp should have been, walked around, poked around, rolled the log, found the L. And it was a very characteristic blaze, mark and L. It was quite different to Lansborough's and all the other L's that popped up subsequently. So I think, you know, there is definitely something that's worth pursuing in the north, where trees may not last as long because of fire, the bad fires that they have every year. But, you know, he did leave it. It wasn't just an L, that's what I'm saying. It was a distinctive mark. The blaze was cut in a particular way and the L in a particular place and size and shape.
But there would still be the problem with the knot in distinguishing between an L blazed in 1845 and one blazed in 1848.
And you have to make allowance for trees growing and the bark growing.
And you don't know if only one person carved the L's. I mean, it's quite likely that different expedition members carved them and perhaps carved them in their own style and fashion. And some men have claimed that...
Not with a Teutonic leader.
Racist stereotype. Some people claim that he only ever marked his trees with a single L, but there are records of trees marked double L. I mean, it's not good enough to say on the basis of one or two or three trees which are shaped this way as an L, the others that are shaped that way are not his or whatever. You know, it's interesting and it's worth considering, but it shouldn't be taken as gospel.
Part of the problem, though, is that mostly all we have is a description that There was a tree with an L.
That's right.
What I'm saying is it's not really enough.
Thank you for that.
As the comments were made in the early historical thing, there were other people who went out on where Leichhardt was in 1847 who had the surname with an L on it, and some of those marked trees as well. And you've also, I've found an engraving, it's a rock engraving out in the Tanami Desert with L and X on it, and you know, it looks very old, it looks weathered like the rock engravings that are on it, but you know, it could be anyone who had that surname, so that's another dilemma situation.
Yeah, or even a Roman numeral.
Yeah.
Susan, can I bring you into the discussion? Of course, the National Library announced to the world this wonderful acquisition of Patrick White material last year, was it? Which sort of fooled everyone. Everyone had believed, Patrick, that he'd burnt all this stuff, but there it was in shoeboxes, etc., all that time. Have you had a chance to have a good look at that, and is there much material there relating to the Voss work?
I haven't had a look at it.
Could you speak in the mic, please?
I haven't had a chance to have a look at it. I've got a graduate student who has been up and has had a bit of a look at the Voss notebook, although that's one of the things that was on display while he was up there. It's just come off display, so he's going up again. The Voss notebook has material dating back to 1939, I think, showing that he started the novel a lot earlier than people had thought. And it does have notes on Leichhardt, but also on Eyre and other things. So, but I haven't looked at it in detail, and the student hasn't had a chance to do that for me either. So there's certainly some additional material there that will give some more matter on exactly who he was reading and what he was reading. But as I was saying, I think he read the letters, for instance, in German, in the German publication, rather than in translation, and I wasn't aware of that before. So.
You mentioned Eyre there as well, so obviously he was looking across various explorers, and that the Leichhardt story wasn't his only inspiration, so perhaps there is more of a composite figure there than we might have anticipated.
Yeah, he was quite adamant about that, and it's really subsequent discussions of Voss that have collapsed all those other explorers and exploration accounts down to say that Voss is Leichhardt. White never said that Voss was Leichhardt or was even solely or primarily based on Leichhardt. I think the fact that Voss is German is one of the reasons that that parallel has been made, but it certainly wasn't White's stated intention that the parallel be drawn so closely between them, and that therefore White gets implicated, of course, in Chisholm's libel against Leichhardt, if you like, because he had read Chisholm and used that idea, I think, as much as taking it, you know, rather than taking it as truth about Leichhardt, he used that notion of a kind of somewhat unstable figure as the leader of an expedition and ran with that. But it certainly wasn't his only inspiration.
Thank you. Some further questions from the floor? Yes. Just up. We'll go one and then two.
Harvey Marchant. Question first to Dick. You mentioned that 1847 was a very wet year. Was it wet enough for the rivers that rise in Queensland and the Northern Territory and dissipate in the Simpson to be flowing in when Leichhardt could have gone that way? I realise those rivers flow slightly east of south, so that were they, or could have they, in your view, been used by Leichhardt as a way to the south?
It's highly problematic because clearly we don't really know the extent of the 1847 rains, but I've tried to look at all the historical figures on rainfall that exist around the place in Australia. It does seem to me there was a fairly wide rainfall on the tiny limited amount you have. You look at someone like Sturt's journals and he's talking about what a terrible time he's having and everything. I think it's because he's never been out there and it's hot, it's hard times, but I really think he's in quite a moderately good season because they always find water, there's rainfall, there is a lot more water than the implications from when you read the how badly everyone's feeling. They're suffering from scurvy and so on like that. Certainly rivers such as the Plenty and the particularly the Fink. Fink's got very big water holes in it, a long way. The Hale River runs down into big soakages. The Todd River joined in a very, very big flood year, like in only a short time ago. We didn't get much rain in the Alice. There are very big flows there. But also, I'm sure Leichhardt would have learned about soakage water by that time, and so that soakages, which are crucially important, but with an Aboriginal population over landscape, they're going to leave evidence, or the smokes are going to be there. There's going to be indications, such as he used in his first expeditions, but which are much more widely reported after him, as the indications of water. So in any moderately good season, I think you'd be able to make your way much better down certain areas, but then you'd be caught out by being trapped down into the Simpson Desert. So, you know, how on earth you make your way from there, unless you've got an Aboriginal guide. There's Aboriginal routes that I've recorded going down the Plenty across to the Hale and then down right into the Andato country.
I might put another question.
If it's a brief one.
It's brief. And that's to David. You talk about the potential for pollen. Is there any indication of how deep what you talked about as being rubbish in the grooves and in some of the stampings of the letters? Because I was thinking that, you know, sort of pollen, when you think of it as in the tens going hundreds of micrometer range, is there space for a collection of pollen there?
Definite.
Thank you.
Definitely.
I got it.
Okay.
Can I just make another comment? Up along the Barku and across to the Flinders, I mentioned the L trees that were there, but in the discussion about rainfall, reminded me that there were also about four or five locations on the headwaters of the Thompson where Captain Walker found the tracks of a large number of horses and mules heading northwest, where Leichhardt said he wanted to go. And clearly, as he pointed out, they'd been made during a very wet period. They were off the creek on the ridges, and the tracks had been stamped deep by the weight of the horses on the soft ground and then hardened, and he pointed out himself, my tracks made in the dry season, we washed away next wet, but these tracks will be here for years. And he said they were very old then. Mm. So if they weren't Leichhardt's, that means that somebody else was out there before Captain Walker. Well, I think there were people getting around all through Queensland and northern South Australia who weren't documented or very poorly documented. Some we know about because they were found dead. Others made reports, but no doubt there were others who didn't make reports, and possibly quite early too. So the story of the massacre, for instance, at Tiriwa, to the east of Mount Dare country somewhere, possibly one Tata waterhole on the Diamantina, could have been a land seeker or a party of land seekers. The same with the supposed grave of Gray from Burke's expedition, which is, I think, quite dubious. But somebody was there and murdered, because it was a European with clothing and all sort of stuff, in way beyond the frontier. So you've got the complicating factors. No matter what story you've got complicating factors.
Yep. Another question just here. Thanks.
Thank you, David Underwood. I've had the pleasure of spending a couple of years out on the Barku area, and the question of rainfall in 47 was wet. Well, if you watch the bomb, as you get used to watching when you live a couple of years out there, the bomb weather site, you'll see that rain can go across that area that Darrell was just talking about, and absolutely nothing down at the southwestern end. And Gwyn Kennedy, what I've read, was down that way in 47, I think, wasn't it? It was drought. What I read from what his description said, it was total drought conditions down that way, and they were in severe trouble. But I would like to pose this question to the panel. I just thought today was wonderful. I didn't know what to expect. I was hoping it was going to be good, but it's been terrific, and thank everybody for that. I just think, you know, I've been dabbling around this, and I ran into Darrell on the net, and he's been most kind and generous in answering all of my silly little questions. And Norma said something about blazing, and I remember I asked Darrell a question like that, and he shot me back a similar answer to what he just gave there. So, you know, it's I really appreciate those sort of things. And he put me in contact with another fellow who we both know on the net, which is interesting, and so on and so forth. And I've been running around a couple little spots, Mitchell and here and so on. But the question that comes to my mind, the more I learn about Leichhardt, is here we've got a wonderful resource for not only Australia but humanity in general. And today's been retrospective in some ways and getting us all up to scratch in others, that I think there's a golden... And all you people have been bubbling away in your own little areas. I mean, you're not on the net. I can't find you. There is no focus for Leichhardt. And yet he's one of the world leaders. It's clear today, the last talk before lunch, I think it was, that wonderful bar graph thing that was up there. You know, that was just tremendous, that. The guy's not on the net. I mean, we've got some rubbish on the net. I found Daryl's CSIRO thing. It was the best thing I found on the net. And hence I checked. I found him anyway. It's not hard to find people. Yeah, why not? But also take it further than that. There needs to be a focus where all this stuff is put on the net and where we get to know who's out there doing stuff. But also the Germans have got this tremendous resource too, with the question from the gentleman from here earlier referring to the museum in Austria where he was. It just ticked over things in my mind. And then there's the Brits, of course, who always rule the waves, and we've heard about their problems. Susan mentioned it today. And which brings me to another point, is one speaker that we could have had today to really round off Leichhardt. It says, who was Ludwig Leichhardt? Well, to me, for the person of that era, he was an exemplar in treating the local people as equals. And if he hadn't have done that, we wouldn't be here talking about him today. He would have been a bloke that wandered around Ipswich and Newcastle and not got much further. And, you know, he's a bit like Australian universities today. They don't get government funding like Mitchell did and Kennedy did. He had to go and get sponsorships like Australian universities do today, do their research. But he still kept his integrity while getting the support of the landholders and, you know, inadvertently helping the imperial cause. Now, his advice on the Boulogne, which we heard about today, was spot on, because I read another document that says total war broke out on the Boulogne later on, a few years later. He advised don't go there. Language, people need to check. Oh, just one more point, and it's a little bit of a thing from me. Language needs to be revised, I think. Out on the Barku, there's a tributary near the Welford National Park on the other side of the bank, and there's two waterholes there. One's called Massacre and one's called Battle. Now, one of them, there was a couple of white blokes in the 60s killed, and the other one is a fair few black fellas killed. I'll work out which one was Battle and which one was Massacre. And some of the language I think we need to revisit, because there's a big argument in suburbia today about home invasions. Are you allowed to knock out the bloke who invades your home?
Well, on that note, any comment from the panel on some of those points raised by David?
The only comment I'd have is I only use a quill pen, mate. I haven't got up to the web yet.
I think, Matt, wasn't the museum considering putting the papers from this day on the web?
We are. That's why we're recording today, so it will be on the web.
So this stuff
on our site
should go on. Yep. But there is a Burke and Will Society, and they're fairly active, and they have on the web, you know, all the different characters involved with Burke and Wills and potted biographies of them, but there should be a Ludwig Leichhardt Society, I agree. I believe there is one in Germany, and there is a Ludwig Leichhardt Museum in Germany as well.
All right, well, thank you very much for that final comment. We have reached closing time, so I'd like to just finish by saying, this morning I said that one of the aims of today was to try to contribute to this ongoing process of resurrecting Leichhardt to the status to which he should be recognised by the Australian and international community. I mean, some of us here today, of course, regard him very highly, but the average person does not. And I think we can say that for the last 7 hours, Leichhardt has lived again in this room. Thanks to our wonderful speakers, and thanks to you for the questions that you've raised, and for everyone who's contributed amongst the staff of the museum. So I'd just like to finally thank our speakers once again.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.